Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for the month of May 2008. Please note that the full text of all articles may be viewed online at ajp.psychiatryonline.org, including all author affiliations and disclosures. This month will begin with a clinical case conference by Carolyn Turvey and Don Klein. Their case illustrates the interactions between depression and comorbid chronic illnesses. Then we'll highlight a report by Marisa Domino and colleagues on the cost-effectiveness of treatments for adolescent depression. We'll also include an editorial by Grayson Norquist and colleagues. Then we'll turn to two long-term studies on the relationship between childhood treatment for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and later substance abuse. In addition, we'll highlight an editorial on these articles by Nora Volkow and James Swanson. Another long-term study on the treatment of patients with borderline personality disorder is presented by Anthony Bateman and Peter Fonagy, a partial hospitalization program that focused on mentalization was compared with treatment as usual. We'll take a look at the results 5 years after the end of treatment. We'll conclude with an article by Amy Pinkman and colleagues on the effect of race in facial processing by African American and Caucasian individuals with schizophrenia. Let's begin with the clinical case conference by Carolyn Turvey and Don Klein, Remission from Depression Comorbid with Chronic Illness and Physical Impairment. The patient is referred to as Mr. R. He was 56 years old and had been a farmhand until he was forced to stop because of chronic medical conditions. He suffered from hypertension, insulin-dependent diabetes, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, congestive heart failure, arthritis, obesity, and repeated episodes of gout. He reported both cognitive and neurovegetative symptoms of depression and had been taking 60 milligrams of citalopram per day for at least a year. The authors note that chronic illness is becoming the predominant medical presentation in late life. People with these impairments need to find a new definition of normal in order to build a satisfactory life. A trial of psychotherapy alone or with medication is often recommended for people with depression and comorbid medical illness. The psychotherapy provided to Mr. R. was tailored in 3 ways. First, it specifically addressed the connection between impairment and mood. Second, it was a hybrid of interpersonal psychotherapy and behavioral activation. Last, it was conducted primarily by telephone. Many chronically ill patients are homebound and are not able or not willing to make weekly visits to a remote medical center. The treatment lasted for 12 sessions. 3 of these were conducted in the patient's home. The others were conducted by telephone and lasted approximately 30 minutes. The first session occurred in person, and it covered ways to maximize open discussion on the telephone. In the past, when Mr. R. faced difficulties, he would throw himself into his work. He was determined to return to his prior level of functioning. He would repeatedly set unrealistic goals, overexert himself, and then find himself incapacitated for several days or a week. This pattern occurred so often that he became very discouraged and stopped setting goals entirely. At the start of the study, his primary activities were watching television and caring for his 18-month-old grandson. One challenge was helping Mr. R. come to terms with his impairment without triggering hopelessness or despair. The therapist made clear that the goal of the therapy was to maximize function and help Mr. R. find more successful ways of achieving his goals. The therapist gently but firmly pointed out that setting unrealistic goals actually precipitated his withdrawal and decline in function, precisely what he was trying to avoid. The therapeutic plan made use of key problem areas used in interpersonal psychotherapy to help patients come to terms with their functional impairment. The first was grief and loss. In this context, the grief was for Mr. R.'s prior level of functioning. One goal of therapy was to help him learn how to readjust his expectations. Because chronic illness is progressive, patients need to readjust their expectations repeatedly. Psychoeducational materials also discuss the interpersonal consequences of becoming functionally impaired. Mr. R. focused primarily on two issues, his difficulty in asking for help and his concerns about being a burden. The discussion of impairment within the framework of loss and role transition occurred primarily in the first four sessions. At that point, the therapist and Mr. R. started to lay the groundwork for the behavioral activation. The therapist instructed Mr. R. to pace himself. For example, he could use ranges when setting goals. Instead of setting the goal of seeding the garden in a single afternoon, he was advised to aim for doing it in the next 3 to 5 days. Likewise, prioritizing goals was emphasized. Instead of attempting 5 goals, he should aim for 1 or 2. Mr. R. defined 2 behavioral goals based on activities that had been meaningful to him in the past, gardening and collecting stamps and coins. To do so, he would need some ongoing support from his wife when his energy failed or when more physically demanding tasks arose. In the past, he had hesitated to ask for help. When he could no longer do these hobbies entirely on his own, he gave them up. During therapy, he solicited help from his wife and was able to sustain both activities. The case of Mr. R. also illustrates the need for the broader theoretical model provided by interpersonal psychotherapy. The course of his recovery was not uniform. After an initial improvement, he suffered low mood related to 2 issues, conflict over care of his grandson and relapse of his gout. These issues would not be anticipated in therapy focused primarily on coping with physical impairment. Since the treatment was based in the broader theory of interpersonal psychotherapy, other techniques could be harnessed to address these issues. In this case, communication and assertiveness skills helped Mr. R. set childcare boundaries with his stepdaughter and receive adequate medical attention for his gout. Now let's turn to the article by Marisa Domino and colleagues, Cost-Effectiveness of Treatments for Adolescent Depression, Results from TADS. The acronym TADS stands for Treatment for Adolescents with Depression Study. Earlier results showed that adolescents with depression had better symptom outcomes after 12 weeks of treatment with fluoxetine than patients treated with placebo. This was true for both fluoxetine monotherapy and for the combination of fluoxetine and cognitive behavioral therapy. CBT alone did not demonstrate improved results over placebo. The costs of treatment are another important concern, and so Domino and colleagues related the efficacy results to monetary and time costs. Their analysis covered 351 adolescents aged 12 to 18 years, and it included both study expenses and costs for other services. In order to approximate total service costs, the time and travel costs for adult caregivers of the study participants were also included. Time was quantified by multiplying hourly wages by the hours spent traveling or waiting. The authors used the patient's scores on the revised Children's Depression Rating Scale to determine quality-adjusted life years for each treatment group. The analysis produced incremental cost-effectiveness ratios, which expressed the marginal cost of 1 unit of improvement in the depression rating. In this 12-week study, treatment with fluoxetine cost only slightly more than placebo. It had comparable costs for time and for services outside the study protocol, and outcomes were clearly better than with placebo. The marginal cost per quality-adjusted life year was relatively low. Cognitive behavioral therapy alone was neither effective nor cost-effective. Combination therapy had the highest total cost, but also the greatest improvement in depression scores, and so it was considered cost-effective. However, it would be recommended over fluoxetine only if the additional clinical improvement is worth the markedly higher cost. The authors note limitations of their analyses. These include the short duration of treatment, which lasted 12 weeks, and the omission of adverse effects, such as suicidality. Other methodologic issues are highlighted in the editorial by Grayson Norquist and colleagues, entitled Cost-Effectiveness of Depression Treatment for Adolescents. they discuss the use of incremental cost-effectiveness ratios. Incremental costs and effects are measured relative to a control, which in this case is the placebo group. The incremental cost-effectiveness ratio for fluoxetine relative to placebo was $61 per unit decrease on the Children's Depression Rating Scale. For combination treatment relative to placebo, it was $249 per unit decrease. In other analyses, the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio for fluoxetine showed it to be 4 to 5 times more cost-effective than combination therapy. The gold standard of clinical efficacy research is comparison to placebo. However, a placebo baseline rather than a no treatment or treatment as usual is problematic for cost-effectiveness analysis because the choice of comparison group affects the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio for the treatment of interest. Incremental costs and incremental effectiveness can be interpreted in a straightforward way when a new treatment is compared with an older treatment. Interpreting an incremental cost-effectiveness ratio with placebo is not straightforward because the costs of placebo treatment are an artifact of the research design. In terms of effects, it is clear that when compared with placebo, the incremental clinical gains of fluoxetine, for example, are due to the active treatment effects of the drug. But what is the meaning of an incremental cost of an active treatment compared with placebo when substantial costs attributed to the placebo exist only because of the research design? The mean cost with placebo was 84% of the cost with fluoxetine. Thus, in the calculation of the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio, the incremental effects of fluoxetine are figured in relation to only 16% of the cost of treatment with the drug. This makes the ratio lower and much more favorable than it would be if fluoxetine were compared to no treatment, which has no effects and no costs. Benchmarking combination therapy against placebo also makes its incremental cost-effectiveness ratio more favorable. But because 57% of the costs of combination therapy are incremental over placebo, the effect on this ratio is proportionally less. Computing incremental cost-effectiveness ratios relative to a costly placebo improves the overall cost-effectiveness of all interventions, and it exaggerates the difference between the drug alone and combination treatment. The chosen measure of treatment effects, quality-adjusted life years, measures both quantity and quality of life years. Quality measures are gleaned from estimates made by one sample of respondents and then extrapolated to the sample under consideration, ideally a sample with similar characteristics. To determine the effect of an intervention on quality of life over time, one multiplies the extra years obtained through the intervention by the health utility assigned to living in a particular condition. One can then determine the cost per quality-adjusted life year and compare various interventions on their costs for providing an added quality-adjusted life year. However, using data from adults to impute values for depressed adolescents may be an unreliable guide to the true benefits from treatment. To evaluate treatment alternatives fully, all of the costs and effects of a treatment should have a chance to emerge. Domino and colleagues use the data available to them, but many clinicians would consider 12 weeks a very short period in which to make a decision about an intervention. Some disorders have longer periods of symptoms, and the effects of some interventions may not be seen until later. Indeed, a recent publication of follow-up data reveals a somewhat different outcome in the TAD study. At 36 weeks, combination therapy continued to show better outcomes, but improvement on CBT alone was similar to fluoxetine alone. In addition, suicidal ideation is another important potential outcome measure, and it appears to be more prominent in those who take fluoxetine alone. If a longer study period showed even more improvement with CBT than fluoxetine, then the incidence of suicidal ideation and medical side effects become more prominent in patients taking fluoxetine alone, then calculations for quality-adjusted life years would change considerably, and cost-effectiveness could change in favor of CBT. Recent studies from outside the United States also indicate uncertainty about the relative cost effectiveness of various interventions for depressed adolescents. A recent British study showed no difference at 28 weeks in the cost effectiveness of fluoxetine alone compared with a combination of fluoxetine and CBT. However, an Australian study of children and adolescents reported that CBT alone was more cost-effective than antidepressant medications. Thus, the issue remains unresolved. Now we'll focus on two long-term studies demonstrating that stimulant treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in young children does not increase the risk of substance abuse in early adulthood. One is by Joseph Biederman and colleagues and is titled Stimulant Therapy and Risk for Subsequent Substance Use Disorders in Male Adults with ADHD, a Naturalistic Controlled 10-Year Follow-Up Study. This study was a prospective follow-up of boys with ADHD. At baseline, they were between the ages of 6 and 18. Most were reassessed at the 10-year follow-up. Of these, 82 had been treated with stimulants during their lifetime, and 30 had not. At the 10-year follow-up, the two groups showed no significant differences in the rates of alcohol use disorders, nicotine dependence, or other substance-related disorders. The age when stimulant treatment began was not related to the risk for later substance use disorders. An age-related difference was apparent in the study by Salvatore Manuzza and colleagues. They report their prospective follow-up study in the article, Age of Methylphenidate Treatment Initiation in Children with ADHD and Later Substance Abuse, Prospective Follow-up into Adulthood. Their study included 176 boys who were treated with methylphenidate between the ages of 6 and 12. At the 17-year follow-up, the authors examined the occurrence of drug use disorders other than alcohol dependence or abuse. The rate for the subjects who had started taking methylphenidate at age 6 or 7 was similar to the rate for matched comparison subjects without ADHD. On the other hand, the rate of drug abuse was statistically significantly higher among those who had begun methylphenidate treatment between the ages of 8 and 12. The findings of these two long-term studies are discussed in an editorial by Nora Volkow and James Swanson. Does childhood treatment of ADHD with stimulant medication affect substance abuse in adulthood? They begin with the concern about a possible connection between stimulant medications and drugs of abuse. Both are able to increase dopamine concentrations in the nucleus accumbens, which is the neural mechanism considered crucial for their reinforcing effects. Indeed, methylphenidate and amphetamine are sometimes abused in some settings. This misuse can produce dependence. Another reason for concern is the timing of exposure. Human epidemiological studies have shown that the earlier an individual is exposed to substances with abuse potential, such as alcohol and nicotine, the greater the risk of abuse and dependence in adulthood. However, the opposite perspective has also been proposed, that stimulant treatment of children and adolescents with ADHD may reduce the risk of later substance abuse. Considering that individuals with ADHD are at higher than normal risk for substance abuse, it is urgent that these two perspectives be addressed properly, yet relatively few clinical studies have done so. Both the Biederman and Manuzza studies document high rates of substance use disorders in their adult cohorts, up to 45%. On the other hand, both demonstrate that the long-established clinical practice of using stimulant medication to treat young children with ADHD neither increases nor decreases the risk for substance abuse in adulthood. Because these findings are relevant to clinical practice, it is important to identify potential sources of uncertainty. These two studies evaluated clinically referred samples, and medication status was not randomized, and so the findings are vulnerable to referral bias. The samples were also small. Also, treatment with stimulants was initiated at an average age between 8 and 9 years, with most children discontinuing treatment after 2 to 6 years on average. Thus, most individuals were probably exposed to stimulants only a short time during childhood, and only a few were likely exposed to stimulants because of treatment during adolescence. In preclinical studies, Exposure to stimulants during the period corresponding with adolescence, but not childhood, increased sensitivity to the rewarding effects of cocaine. Therefore, prospective studies of larger samples of adolescents treated with stimulants are necessary to more carefully evaluate the consequences of stimulant exposure during this developmental period. An interesting finding of the Biederman study is the failure to confirm the prior claim that treatment with stimulants markedly reduced the risk for substance abuse. They suggest that the prior finding was because of a temporary benefit that delayed the initiation of drug abuse. This merits further investigation, since reduction of drug exposure during this developmental stage would be expected to result in improved outcomes, including less risk for dependence. However, others have proposed a parsimonious explanation, that the untreated ADHD group was an average of 2 years older than the treated group, and that an uncontrolled age difference accounted for the difference in substance use that increased with age during adolescence. An interesting finding from the Manuza study is the observation that subjects who began stimulant treatment after 8 years of age had greater substance abuse that was mediated by an increase in antisocial personality disorder in adulthood. Remarkably, the subgroup with treatment before the age of 8 did not differ from comparison subjects in lifetime rates of non-alcohol substance abuse. The authors discussed the possibility that early stimulant treatment of ADHD may have had a protective effect against the emergence of conduct disorder, which usually precedes antisocial personality disorder and increases the risk for drug abuse. However, this hypothesis is not supported by early findings from the multimodal treatment study of ADHD, a prospective follow-up study. Stimulant treatment in that study did not selectively reduce conduct disorder. In addition, over the past decade, there has been a fivefold increase in the treatment of ADHD with stimulants in the United States, but no change in the prevalence of conduct disorder. The two articles in this issue highlight the need to develop a better understanding of the natural history of ADHD over time. It was once assumed that ADHD was a childhood disorder. Later, this idea was rejected, and it was proposed that ADHD will persist in a large number of individuals. Thus, an important question is whether the condition limited to childhood and the form continuing into adulthood have different neurobiologies and whether they have different vulnerabilities for substance abuse and for long-term effects of stimulant treatment. A fundamental question is why there is such a high comorbidity between ADHD and substance abuse. There is evidence of impaired brain dopamine activity in individuals with ADHD, which could explain why these individuals are at a greater risk of abusing drugs, since drugs of abuse acutely but temporarily raise the dopamine concentrations in the brain and could temporarily improve ADHD symptoms. In contrast, chronic drug abuse decreases dopamine brain activity. Inasmuch as dopamine modulates the activity of brain regions implicated in the symptoms of ADHD, chronic drug exposure in ADHD individuals could exacerbate the symptoms of the disorder. Now we'll turn to the treatment of borderline personality disorder. Anthony Bateman and Peter Fonagy present long-term results in their article, 8-Year Follow-Up of Patients Treated for Borderline Personality Disorder, Mentalization-Based Treatment versus Treatment as Usual. The study treatment consisted of 18 months of partial hospitalization with individual and group psychotherapy. Expressive therapy using art and writing groups was included. Crises were managed within the team, and medication was prescribed according to a protocol by a psychiatrist in the therapy program. All aspects of treatment were oriented toward understanding behavior in terms of the patient's underlying mental states. In psychotherapy, the patient and therapist collaboratively generated alternative perspectives to the patient's subjective experience of him or herself and others. The therapy ranged from validating and supportive interventions to exploration of the therapy relationship itself. This psychodynamic therapy was manualized and in many respects overlapped with transference-focused psychotherapy. At the end of 18 months, the patients were offered another 18 months of mentalizing group therapy, which was conducted on an outpatient basis twice a week. the study intervention was compared with treatment as usual. This consisted of general psychiatric outpatient care, medication prescribed by the consultant psychiatrist, community support for mental health services, and periods of partial hospital and inpatient treatment as necessary, but no specialist psychotherapy. Patients were randomly assigned to the two treatments. Results were compared 8 years after random assignment, which was at least 5 years after the end of the mentalization-based therapy. 22 patients in the follow-up evaluation had received the mentalization treatment, and 19 received treatment as usual. The follow-up interviewers were blind to the original group allocation. The primary outcome measure was the number of suicide attempts over the 5 years after discharge. Overall, 46% of the patients made at least one suicide attempt. However, the rate was only 23% for the patients who received mentalization-based treatment, contrasted with 74% for the group receiving treatment as usual. A significant difference between the groups was apparent as early as the outpatient phase of mentalization treatment. Differences between groups were also found on the use of services, global function, and scores on the Zanarini rating scale for borderline personality disorder. The patients who received treatment as usual received more services over time, perhaps because they continued to have more symptoms. In both groups, scores on the Global Assessment of Functioning scale continued to indicate deficits. Nevertheless, when compared to the group who received treatment as usual, the patients receiving the mentalization therapy were more likely to be functioning reasonably well and to have some meaningful relationships. More striking was how badly the treatment as usual group managed, despite significant input. Suicide attempts during follow-up were almost 10 times more common in this group as in the mentalization group. Associated with this were more emergency room visits and greater use of polypharmacy. However, although the number of hospital days was greater for this group, the percentage of patients admitted to the hospital during follow-up was only 25% to 33%. Now we'll conclude with the article by Amy Pinkman and colleagues, "The Other Race Effect in Face Processing Among African American and Caucasian Individuals with Schizophrenia." Their study demonstrates that patients with schizophrenia are better able to remember faces and recognize facial expressions when the face represents a person of the same race as the viewer. This effect is well established in healthy people, but it is particularly relevant to patients with schizophrenia because tests using facial images are frequently administered to assess cognitive functioning. Earlier research showed that non-Caucasian patients performed more poorly on these tests than Caucasian patients. However, studies that tested patients from both ethnic groups but only used pictures of Caucasian faces may have biased the findings in favor of the Caucasian group. The Pinkham study included both ethnic groups in the facial images as well as among the test participants. The race effect was tested in 270 patients with schizophrenia and in healthy subjects. The patients did have poorer performances than the comparison subjects on immediate recall of faces, delayed recall of faces, and recognition of emotions. However, both groups showed different levels of accuracy depending on the race of the participant and the race of the facial image being viewed. In the immediate recall, African American participants were more likely to recognize same race faces than other race faces. In the delayed recall, all participants better recognized faces of their own race. In emotion recognition, African American and Caucasian participants performed similarly when identifying emotion in African American faces, but both African American and comparison subjects had disproportionately worse accuracy for Caucasian faces. The authors described the implications of these effects for the measurement of face processing in schizophrenia. Specifically, findings of greater impairment in African American patients are spurious when Caucasian faces are used as stimuli. The presence of an intact other race effect in schizophrenia also suggests a normative developmental pattern. An other race effect can be found in very young children, and it increases over the course of childhood. These developmental changes suggest that this effect may be experientially related and driven by greater exposure to same-race faces than to other race faces during childhood. Thus, despite face processing deficits in other domains, the other race effect exhibited by individuals with schizophrenia may reflect normative developmental experiences with faces, and perhaps even normative development of the neural mechanisms of face processing. It would be informative to compare individuals with schizophrenia to people with other neurodevelopmental disorders, such as autism, who similarly show face processing deficits in adulthood, but demonstrate deficits with face experience throughout childhood. This concludes the audio highlights of the May issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. We invite you to refer to the online issue at hap.psychiatryonline.org for the full text of these and other articles. We also welcome comments regarding this audio. They can be emailed to Jane Weaver. Her email address is jweaver@psych.org. Thank you.